But fundamentally underlying the meaning, he hears just the sound. And this is something you get too if you go to a foreign country and you don't understand the language and you see all the people talking. And you notice things that they don't notice about themselves because they get absorbed in the meaning of what they're saying. And so they don't notice. The fascinating aspect of the perfectly meaningless side of their behavior. But at any rate, the whole approach of the whole result of the Bodhisattva doctrine in the art of the Far East is to create what Spiegelberg has called the religion of non-religion, where the religion became so perfect that it left no trace. It's like when you build a house, you erect scaffolding. When you finish, you take the scaffolding away. And you wonder, if you'd never seen a house being built, how on earth the builders got up so high. So in the same way, the ancient idea of Buddhism is that the Buddhism is a ferry boat. And it's designed to take you across the stream from this shore, which is samsara, the rat race, to the other shore, which is nirvana. When you get on the other side, you get off the ferry, see? The ferry boat goes back to bring the next party over. But if you stay on the ferry boat, that means, you see, you're in love with the ferry boat. And you're in danger of becoming a religious maniac. And people do that, you see. You know how it is. You've probably had that experience. People who join a church and then become fascinated with all the things that go with church. They like Bibles, not just for what's in them, but the smell of a Bible, the appearance of the Bible, has something holy and numinous about it. And they like crucifixes. Now, a crucifix is a pretty grisly object, a corpse nailed on beams. But they get jeweled crucifixes, beautiful works of art, enameled, gorgeous things. And people with a great religious feeling love to finger those things, you see. And Buddhists, too, do that. They like their rosaries and their Buddha images and the smell of incense. And they get a kind of churchification. The French have a wonderful word for those goods. They call them bon dieuserie. And it's a little difficult to translate. Literally, good godery. but le bon Dieu, you know, everybody, some of this sentimental piece, oh, le bon Dieu. The old lady is always talking about le bon Dieu. And so people say, you know, people who've got church on the brain, le bon Dieu. So all these stores sell bon dieuserie. Now, while this, you see, is in its own way understandable, the whole point is that in the supreme state of understanding, you get rid of bon dieuserie altogether. That's the religion of no religion. See? You don't even have any beliefs. The whole creed, everything, is utterly past surpassed. That means you've left the ferry boat and you've gone on the other shore. You don't carry the ferry boat with you. And so, this religion of no religion is very pure, very transparent. It's called like the salt in water, like the glue in color, or in ink. You see, a stick ink that the Chinese make has glue in it to hold it together. But you can't see the glue. It's all solid black all the way through, and the glue isn't observable. So the salt isn't observable in water. In this way, you see, religion is being used as a medicine and not as a diet. The Dharma is to use a Zen expression, it's like picking up a brick to knock at somebody's door. And when the door opens, you don't carry the brick into the house. So a person, you see, who has much religion has what is called in Zen a Zen stink. And that's considered rather bad, a rather specially bad smell. And one of the Zen poems says, to know your original mind, your essential nature, that is the great disease of our religion, of our school. See? So people who have this thing, who have Zen, and you can say, well, that fellow's a Buddhist, and he has this special thing he has, you know? It's like those of us who have the disadvantage of our eyes not being quite good, we have to wear spectacles. And this nuisance you carry around with you all over the place, gadget you have to fix on you. And or people who belong, like clergy, to a religious order have to go around in funny clothes. And the rabbi, who has a beautiful beard, but he will wear a beastly black Homburg hat, which is so unnatural, you see. So they have this apparatus. In a way, they're like people with artificial legs, crutches, and so on. So it isn't something that's worked. It isn't working like a medicine. Because if the medicine works, you get rid of it. If the doctor is successful, he gets rid of his patients. And so in exactly this way, suchness is an attempt to say something which can't be said. It is trying to say, there, the world, just as it is, you see, that's what we're trying to show you to look at. We're not trying to drag in some fancy apparatus from above, some special system which has got to be imposed on you, some all kinds of gods and complicated people you've got to believe in. We're not going to fill your brains with a lot of new stuff, but instead come to the clarity of seeing things just the way they are. The trouble is, when somebody said to a Zen master, the lines of the hills and the clouds, are not all these the body of Buddha? He said, yes, but it's a pity to say so. And so even to have to say, look, that, see, it's just a little bit too much. Just a little bit too much. It would be more admirable if I didn't have to say anything, didn't have to point out a thing. But after all, one does have to make some concessions to folly. This morning, I was discussing various aspects of what might be called the religion of no religion. Considering religion as a raft for crossing a river, or rather, religion in the sense of dharma, not so much the doctrine as the method. Considering it as the raft for crossing a river, as the brick for knocking at a door, as a medicine to cure a sickness, which when it's worked, you get rid of. And I was showing you that this in the Far East culminated in a type of life, a way of life, where to some very large extent the outward symptoms of religiousness disappear, especially in the art forms, where the icon ceases to be the figure of the holy person or the deity or whatever, and becomes simply a flowering branch, a rock, flowing water, clouds, birds, and funny little old men. You know, a curious thing goes on in the whole world of religious practice. And that is, the older a religion gets, the more the distance of time lends such eminence to its original founders that they become superhumanized, and the practice of the religion that they founded becomes sort of derived of power. It just sinks into going through the motions because people say, well, we're living in a decadent age. In the past, there were these great heroes who did all these marvelous things, Buddha and Jesus and Confucius and all their great followers. But today, everybody is rotten. And nobody can expect to get more than a little way. I had a friend who went to India. He was an astonishing fellow because he was earnest. He would do anything. He was full of the power of self-discipline. And he put himself under an Indian master who came to this country in the first place. And he became a vegetarian and he practiced yoga every day. And he was determined to get that thing. So finally, his teacher told him the best place he could go to in India. And off he went and he joined a yoga school. There was a whole faculty and everybody was practicing yoga. And he was so earnest and he was so devoted that within 4 weeks, he could do everything that the other students could do. And they'd been there maybe 2 or 3 years. And so when he got to that, he mastered all the physical postures and the breathing exercises and the concentration exercises. And so he said to one of the older students, now, what about real samadhi? Do you get that around here? And the student said, no, none of us have got it yet. You better ask the teachers. So he began asking around the members of the faculty, what about samadhi? Do you get this? Well, they said, no, not yet. Well, he said, I'm willing, he said, to spend any amount of time here. I don't have to get back. I've got just enough funds to get by. And so I'm willing to do anything you tell me, to practice with all my heart. Can you, do any of you have samadhi? They said, well, no, not yet. Does anybody, can you direct me to someone who does have it? Well, I said about 125 years ago, there was someone who was really considered to have had it. And so then he began to think, why is it then that when the members of the faculty come out of their meditation period, they all look as if they just had a good sleep? You see? There begins to always grow up the concept of a golden age. There are our forefathers, they really knew how to do it. But today, everything's falling apart. Do you know people have been saying that for centuries? There is an Egyptian text on the panels of some pyramid, temple or whatnot, 6,000 years old, in which an Egyptian priest is complaining that everybody's falling apart. So, the lesson of this is, everybody here has just as much capacity as Buddha had. Nobody, who was Buddha's teacher? Think about that. Who psychoanalyzed Freud? Somebody has to start. And so everybody has the potentiality of being the first one. So I call this problem the distance of excessive reverence. It has the disadvantage, you see, of making all these problems that we're discussing and states of consciousness that I've been talking about. It makes them seem impossibly remote, as if they were something attainable only by a very, very favored few. And that's a very frustrating attitude to get. We were discussing this morning the sense that people have when they read Zen literature, that the thing is just round the corner. I just almost was on it. See, that's much more healthy attitude than that, oh, this thing will require many, many years of practice. Now, it so often turns out, you know, that the person who feels that it's just round the corner will feel this way for many years. Only, he won't be put off by the idea of many, many years' work yet to do. But will always, in the feeling that it's always, almost instantly available, his interest will be maintained for an extraordinarily long time. Thinking of how much work there is to be done just puts some people out of commission. You know, you've got to answer a lot of letters, and they've stacked up and stacked up and stacked up. It's an appalling pile. And eventually everything gets so complicated that you're inclined to take the whole bunch of correspondence and throw it in the fire. But if you have to answer it, for some reason or other, you can only answer it one letter at a time. Same way with washing dishes. When they pile up on the drying board, and you get this mountain of dishes, and you think, oh, I've got to go through that. I've done it before, I've got to do it again this afternoon, and for year in and year out, I can see all those dishes I've got to wash in the future, and lo and behold, the pile of dishes on the draining board grows higher and higher in your mind's eye until it's absolutely overwhelming. And you say, well, maybe some super dishwasher, some kitchen maid of the past who was a great hero, would undertake this sort of life. But poor little me, I can't do that sort of thing. Whereas the only way to wash them is one by one, as if each one was the only one you had to wash. That's obvious. So, don't be discouraged by this attitude that you find so commonly among Asian peoples in their feeling about Buddhism and Hinduism, that it's something so great that it's only cut out for very few supermen. Don't let that put you off. It may be true statistically. When you review the vast, vast multitude of human beings that there are, but so, likewise, from a statistical point of view, this group of you gathered here, and maybe some comparable groups dotted around the country in various places, constitute a tiny, tiny fragment of the total population. And I suppose some external observer could say, of you, rare, rare indeed, are the people who are interested enough in all this to give it, you know, a weekend's thought even. But from your own subjective standpoint, you're not a statistic. You're not one of a special elect few, such that you've joined a secret society and have become self-conscious about it. You may be, from a certain point of view, one of an elect few, but from your own point of view, you're just your own direct, perfectly straightforward self, with no particular claims to fame or whatever it may be. So don't be put off by the distance of excessive reverence when it comes to all these things. Well, now, I want to take a further step in getting across the idea of thusness. I made already some mention of looking at words as if they were things that had no meaning, but were just noises, but interesting noises, just as the shape of a leaf is an interesting shape. Now, consider first of all the shape of a leaf. It's something that goes like this, you see. And it's green, you know, and it floats on a tree. and it is a method whereby the tree absorbs moisture. And there are all sorts of people who will want to say to you, you see, really, a leaf is a very rational thing. It exists so that the tree can absorb moisture, and they can go on describing it, and you see all the wonderful ways in which this little leaf works as a kind of a moisture-absorbing, breathing thing. And you say, yes, by Jove, isn't that great? That's very rational. Marvelous thing a tree is. And yet when you consider that the object of the leaf is to absorb certain things that are necessary for the maintenance of the tree, then you must ask the next question, look at the tree as a whole, standing there, bushy and bright, and you say, well, what's that for? Well, I mean, what purpose is served by the tree? Well, people say it has something to do with the oxygen in the atmosphere.